You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
Revelation chapter 11, a particularly difficult chapter to interpret in a particularly difficult book. So this is going to be pretty hard to get through, but the payoff is definitely worth it. Revelation chapter 11, verse 1. I was given a reed like a measuring rod and was told, go and measure the temple of God and the altar with its worshipers, but exclude the outer court. Do not measure it because it has been given to the Gentiles. They will trample on the holy city for 42 months. And I will appoint my two witnesses, and they will prophesy for 1,260 days. Clothed in sackcloth. They are the two olive trees and the two lampstands, and they stand before the Lord of the earth. This is an allusion back to Zechariah chapter 4, where the prophet sees these two olive trees, and the interpretation is these are two chosen ones, anointed ones. So it's the same imagery here. John is seeing the same imagery as before in Zechariah. Verse 5, if anyone tries to harm these two witnesses, these two prophets, fire comes out of their mouths and devours their enemies. This is how anyone who wants to harm them must die. They have power to shut up the heavens so that it will not rain during the time they are prophesying. They have power to turn the waters into blood and to strike the earth with every kind of plague as often as they want. Now, when they have finished their testimony, the beast that comes up from the abyss will attack them and overpower them and kill them. Their bodies will lie in the public square of the great city, which is figuratively called Sodom and Egypt, where also their Lord was crucified. For 3.5 days, some from every people, tribe, language, and nation will gaze on their bodies and refuse to bury them. The inhabitants of the earth will gloat over them and will celebrate by sending each other gifts because these two prophets had tormented those who live on the earth. But after 3.5 days, the breath of life from God entered into them and they stood on their feet and terror struck those who saw them. Then they heard a loud voice from heaven saying to them, come up here. And they went up to heaven in a cloud while their enemies looked on. At that very hour, there was a severe earthquake and a tenth of the city collapsed. 7,000 people were killed in the earthquake and the survivors were terrified and gave glory to the God of heaven. The second woe has passed. The third woe is coming soon. Whoa. Wow. What do we do with this passage? Well, let's start from the very beginning. Verse 1. What does it mean, the temple of God? Some interpreters take this to be symbolic. This is a symbolic temple, and this imagery that John is seeing is really a symbol for the church. When we say the church, we're referring to all of the individual followers of Jesus, authentic Christians, who comprise the body of Christ, the church, the Christian community. So when it says that he saw a temple of God, he's not referring to a building, for goodness sakes. He's referring to people, the church. There is some warrant for this interpretation. Namely, in the book of Revelation, believers are called the temple of God. And if you go outside the book of Revelation, I mean, we could just add verse upon verse upon verse. You are the temple of the Holy Spirit. Believers in Jesus. You are God's temple. I mean, over and over, the old temple, I mean, you know, bricks and stones and mortar, that's all been done away with. Solomon's temple was destroyed. Herod's temple was destroyed. And the church is the new temple. And as some interpreters say, this entire section, therefore, should be taken symbolically. Leon Morris, a fantastic New Testament scholar, when he's working on the Gospels, his commentary on the book of Revelation is awful. It is just awful. We get stuff like this. that the entire chapter is just supposed to be taken as symbol. I reject this view. This view is wrong. This is not symbol. I take this to be a literal third temple. Solomon's temple was completed in 967 BC, then it was destroyed. Then it was rebuilt under Ezra and Nehemiah all the way up until the time of Herod, finished around 20 BC, but then that was destroyed as well in AD 70. Now I'm saying there's going to be a future third temple. Remember, John, the author, wrote this during the reign of a particular emperor, Domitian, who ended his reign in AD 96. John is writing this in AD 95, so the second temple has already been destroyed, and he's saying there's going to be another temple in the future. Why would I think this? For one, the view that this is symbolic of the church, the temple is the church, has internal problems, not the least of which is very, very early, verse 1, measure the temple of God and the altar with its worshipers. Now, I might be dumb, but I'm not stupid. This says here, measure the temple of God. Who's that? The worshipers, the believers in Jesus. Measure the temple of God, that's us, and its worshipers. If the temple is the worshipers, why does it add with its worshipers? That is a nonsensical interpretation. And if it doesn't make sense, then we should reject it flat out. Furthermore, in verse 19, we read that God's temple in heaven was opened. So, if the temple is supposed to be all believers in verse 1, what is this other temple in verse 19? These are two separate temples. Is the church cut in half? Is that what this is describing here? Furthermore, Jews and Gentiles, remember we just read that we have the temple with its worshipers and then the outer court that is given over to the Gentiles. This entire complex is supposed to be symbolic of the church. The church is neither Jew nor Greek, slave nor free, male nor female. Christ is the, through his work on the cross in Ephesians 2, through his body, he's broken down that dividing wall. So Jews and Gentiles are brought together, and yet in this very passage, it says that the Gentiles are out and the worshipers of God are in. See, I would have a theological problem with that reading. Furthermore, many other passages state that there is going to be another temple, at least a third temple. Paul, 2 Thessalonians 2, now I'm citing these passages faithfully. In context, this passage is referring to the end of human history. That's the context of this passage. Paul says, the man of lawlessness, that is the Antichrist, will oppose and will exalt himself over everything that is called God or is worshipped, and he will install himself in God's temple, naos in Greek, same word, in God's temple, proclaiming himself to be God. What do interpreters who hold that this is symbolic of the church state? This is also referring to the church, in God's temple, the church. Paul never uses the words in God's temple in this way to refer to the church. Does he refer to the church as God's temple? Yes, but never in this way. Here, we're not reading a letter that's in the apocalyptic or prophetic genre, as in Revelation, where it's heavily laden with symbol. Here, we're reading an epistle, a letter, and it says that there's going to be this guy that goes into God's temple, and he's going to make himself out to be God. This is not referring to the church. It's referring to a literal, physical temple. Then we got Jesus. Jesus said in his teaching on this, in the Mount of Olives, he said in verse 15, when you see standing in the holy place the abomination that causes desolation, spoken of through the prophet Daniel, then Matthew adds a little parenthetical note, let the reader understand. I don't think Jesus said that. I don't think Jesus said, hey, let the reader understand. He's just speaking. I think Matthew added that part in. You don't care. I'm going to keep going. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Spoken of through the prophet Daniel. Well. There's only one passage in Daniel that lines up with what Jesus is speaking about here. Daniel 9, verse 27. There we read, "The people of the ruler who will come will destroy the city and the sanctuary." When did that happen? AD 70. Daniel was writing this in the 5th century BC. He predicted the destruction of Jerusalem and the Jewish temple in AD 70. That's going to happen. War will continue until the end. Ooh, there's a clue. We're moving forward to the end of history. "He will confirm a covenant with many for 1 7. In the middle of the seven, he will put an end to sacrifice and to offering. And at the temple, he will set up an abomination that causes desolation until the end that is decreed is poured out on him. When you see standing," what's this referring to? In Mark 13, 14, Mark uses the masculine participle. Standing is the masculine participle. Read the ESV. It says, "He who is standing." There's a man. There's a man inside the temple who is standing there. He who is standing. Who is that? The people of the ruler who is to come. Therefore, when it says, "He will confirm a covenant," that is not referring to Jesus, as some interpreters hold. That is wrong. This is referring to anti-Jesus, the Antichrist. Because Jesus says, when you see standing, when you see him standing in the holy place, causing the abomination that causes desolation, that's not referring to him. It's referring to this future individual whom we just read about in 2 Thessalonians 2:4, who comes into the temple displaying himself to be God himself. So that's the people of the ruler and the he, the Antichrist, there. The holy place is described here. It's going to be destroyed, the sanctuary. However, then we read just a little bit later in the very next verse, even though the city and the temple are going to be destroyed, verse 27, he's going to put an end to sacrifice and offering and at the temple. Wait a minute. At the temple was just destroyed. This must mean that it's being rebuilt. Between verse 26 and verse 27, we're getting an indication from the text that it's been destroyed in verse 26, but then it's back in verse 27. The abomination that causes desolation, this comes right out of Daniel 9. Jesus is saying, "Let the reader understand," spoken of through the prophet Daniel, and he cites Daniel 9, 27. We got the right text. And as Jesus continues, verse 21, "There will be a great tribulation such as has not occurred since the beginning of the world until now, nor ever will." This is not referring to AD 70, as some interpreters hold. There have been way, way, way worse wars than in AD 70. This is future, unless those days had been cut short. No life would have been saved. This is the end of the world, people. And he says that great tribulation is going to be for 1 7. What does that mean? I've read somewhere between 20 to 30 commentators and scholars on this prophecy of Daniel 9, 24 to 27. I'm not flexing on you. It's only four verses, okay? It's not that big of a deal. However, in all of that reading, of all those scholars, whether they're Christian interpreters, Jewish interpreters, secular interpreters, atheistic interpreters, skeptical interpreters, all of them, univocally, with one voice, say that these sevens in Daniel refer to sets of 7 years. Sets of 7 years. The word is Shabua in Hebrew. It refers to a set. So everybody agrees on this, whether you're a critic or a Christian. I misspoke. There was one skeptic I read who said that Christians make this out to be sets of 7 years, but he had a PhD in pharmacology. That was his expertise. And he thought that the word here for seven was heptad. Hepta in Greek is seven. That's the word in Greek. This is in the Old Testament. This is in Hebrew. So he didn't even have the right word, let alone the right interpretation. Anyways, I'm gloating. Let's keep going. What does all this mean? Maybe I lost you there for a little bit. Let's try and summarize this. What is this saying? It's saying that God is going to return to the nation of Israel. That's what. When Jesus speaks about this, when we read about this here, when Paul talks about it, Israel, Israel, Israel. Jesus speaks about this and he says, this is going to happen in Judea, and then you must flee out of Judea. Pray that it's not on the Sabbath. Whatever this period of history is, it's not what we're used to right now. This is reverting back to some sort of old covenant or focused on the nation of Israel. Whatever it is, it's describing the nation of Israel, and God is getting back with them. Really, God was working through the nation for 1,500 years. Then he's working through the church, Jews and Gentiles alike, and then he's going to get back with the nation of Israel at the end of history once again. So that's what this is teaching. The temple, the city, the witnesses, it's all Israel-centric. It's saying that this tribulation period, as we just read, that final set of 7 years is the tribulation era. There's going to be a 7-year tribulation where, quite literally, all hell is going to break loose on planet Earth, as we've been reading in the book of Revelation. And finally, the Antichrist, this figure, the prince of the ruler who is to come, he, what's the nearest antecedent? The prince of the ruler who is to come, he is going to make a covenant for 1-7, but in the middle of the 7, he will put an end to sacrifice and offering. And the temple, which he sets up, he's going to perform an abomination in this temple, probably what Paul was referring to, claiming to be God. I don't know what could be more of an abomination than standing up in God's temple and saying that I am actually God incarnate. So that is the picture that we're seeing here. There's going to be a temple, and it's being fleshed out very clearly when we just follow what Jesus taught. Read Daniel, read Paul, and read the rest of the prophets. John here is recreating Ezekiel's visions. In chapter 10, John gets a vision of eating a scroll, and it's sweet to the mouth, but it's bitter to the stomach. And this is representative of God's word, that when you eat God's word, so to speak, you digest it. It's very sweet to the taste, but as John digests it, he starts to think about all of this judgment that's going to come upon the earth. Guess where he gets that from? Right out of Ezekiel chapter 3. Here he's seeing a temple in the very next chapter. Where does that come from? Directly out of Ezekiel, the very end of Ezekiel, the final 9 chapters, Ezekiel 40 through 48. Where it describes in painstaking detail, meticulous detail. I mean, it is, if this is your Bible reading for the week, God bless you. I just feel like this is so hard to get through when you read this, talking about how many cubits each part of the temple is going to be and the instruments and who's going to be there and how far it's going to be. I'll just give you an idea here. Here's Ezekiel 40. There it is. Ezekiel 41. There it is. Ezekiel 42, 43. 44, 45, 46, 47, 48. This is a mountain of scripture. People who say, oh, well, Ezekiel's temple, that's also symbolic for, guess who? The church. 260 verses about us. It's describing us, the cubits and the lengths and the heights and the widths and the river going down the middle. No, it's all describing us, the church. Oh, I've read them all on this. They're like, no, it's referring to Herod's temple. Herod's temple looked nothing like that. Okay, nothing like that. Well, it's referring to the temple and the new heavens and new earth. There in Revelation 21 and 22, it says, quote unquote, there is no temple. There is no temple in heaven. So where is this temple going to be built? Some people, Leslie Allen, one scholar, says, he bites the bullet. He says, this was never fulfilled. See, I don't buy that. I don't buy that at all. Other passages predict this third temple. Jesus predicts it. Paul predicts it. Daniel predicts it. We've already seen them. Also, Isaiah predicts it. Jeremiah, Zechariah, Malachi. I mean, these are the big heavy hitters in the Old Testament. They all predict this. They're all saying there's going to be another temple. Well, this is all symbolism in Ezekiel. There's not really going to be a new temple. Ezekiel knew how to write symbolically, okay, just like the rest of us. If you reach down and felt his wrist. Yes, he did have a pulse. He was able to write with symbolism. Of course he was. In Ezekiel 37, he sees a valley of dry bones. And he's like, what is this? Well, that's the regathering of Israel. Symbol. Here? Not symbol. In fact, we read in Ezekiel 12, verse 23, the days are near when every vision will be fulfilled. So much for that idea that this will never be fulfilled. like that one guy, Leslie Allen, I just cited to you. Or that this will be fulfilled in heaven where there is no temple. Or this was fulfilled in Herod's temple, something like that. No. It's not going to happen. Every vision will be fulfilled, according to Ezekiel. Ezekiel 43, make known to them, this is right in the middle of all this, this description of 260 verses. Right in the middle of this, he slips this verse in, 43:11, make known to them the design of the temple, its pattern, its exits, its entrances, and the whole design, so that they may observe its entire design and all its statutes and do them. Why was this written? It was written so that it would be built. That's why. That's why you have architectural plans for this huge, gargantuan temple at the end of history. This is how the book of Ezekiel ends. All right. Well, better settle down. All right. The temple of God, literal. When it says that you have to measure the temple, now what's that saying? I believe in the vision he literally measured it. But what does that mean, to measure the temple? Interpreters of various stripes all hold that this means that he was showing through symbolism that this needed to be preserved. God was going to preserve the temple. Kind of like if you buy a house, you go into the house and you measure the floors. You know, you measure things inside there. What's that saying? It's saying, I own this. And God is saying, I own this temple. It's the temple of God. It belongs to me. The worshipers, who are they? In this period of history, probably Jewish believers in Jesus, and then the people in the outer court of the temple, they're the Gentiles. Now, these are non-believers, people that don't believe in God, because they trample on the city for 42 months. Remember, we've been seeing war and fighting throughout the book of Revelation. That's what we're seeing here. Even within the city of Jerusalem, you've got Jewish believers in Jesus, and then you've got people that don't believe in God, and they're trampling the city. For how long? Oh, how long's the tribulation? 7 years. This says, and when was the Antichrist going to break the covenant he established with Jerusalem? Halfway through that 42 months. Trample the city for half of that period. This is correlating together. Hope you can see that. Half of 7 years is 42 months. That's right what we read out of the book of Daniel. Right what we read from Jesus, alluding to Daniel. And it's referring to the holy city. In verse 8, it says, the city where also their Lord was crucified. Commentators on this are wild. Leon Morris says, this could be any and every city. It just represents mankind. The city, the great city where their Lord was crucified. Any and every city. Jesus was not crucified in any and every city. Other commentators, the majority, say this is Rome. Rome. Where do they get this from? How do you come up with this stuff? We just pull that out of a hat? Rome. We just get to say Rome. The great city where also their Lord was crucified. That's Jerusalem. We're in Jerusalem with the temple. We continue in verse 3. I will appoint 2 witnesses are going to be there, and they will prophesy for 1,260 days. Again, interpreters who are like, the book of Revelation is very symbol-laden, everything's symbolic. You can't really read it in a straightforward manner. They say that this can't be like 2 literal witnesses. Oh, come on. The Antichrist makes war with 2 guys. How hard would it be just to bump off 2 guys? Pretty hard, actually. If you read your Old Testament, Elijah was protected by God, Moses was protected by God, and here we see that they are supernaturally protected by God. So that's hard when you got God protecting you for a while. They point out that this whole imagery of the lampstands, the olive trees, well, I don't know about the olive trees, but the lampstands, in Revelation 1:20, that refers to believers. Believers, the churches, they're the lampstands. So this just refers to the church. Not so fast. When you think about this, that imagery of lamps is used in the book of Revelation, same book, for symbolism for the Holy Spirit, for Jesus, and for God the Father. So we can't just say, well, it's used once as a symbol for the church and believers, so therefore, it's referring to the church, while it's also used for all 3 persons of the Trinity. These lamps and olive trees comes right out of the book of Zechariah, as I already read. And in the book of Zechariah, that refers to two literal witnesses, prophets. Others say this describes just generally the persecution of the church. G.K. Beale, Leon Morris, Mounts, all these guys say it's just describing two witnesses are the church, us, in the tribulation, and they're being persecuted. Okay. How do they die then? Remember we read that thing where they die for 3.5 days? Does that mean that the church at the end of history dies? Like we're just wiped off the face of the earth? Jesus said that the gates of Hades will not overpower the church. So Jesus says the church will never be overpowered, but Greg Beale says that it will be overpowered. They're going to be killed. That is the symbol, right? Symbol is the church. So that means if they're dead, then the church is gone. Here's his retort. He says the quote-unquote death of the prophets, the church, is really hyperbolic for being, quote, driven underground. You're dead. I guess you're driven underground, kind of like the underground church. And that, quote, a universal silence will fall on the church at the very end of history. Oh, come on. If you can believe that, you can believe anything, all right? If you can buy into that, that this death of these prophets refers to the church, and that refers to them being sent underground and not being able to speak or whatever, it doesn't say that the prophets are going to be laid dormant. It says that they're going to be laid dead. That's the language. And the breath of life needs to come back into them so that they're recharged and powered up and ready to go back into action. I'm going with literal prophets here. Probably Elijah and Moses. I'm about 80-20 on Elijah. I'm about 60-40 on Moses on this. Here's why. They appear to be human, for one. They got bodies and tombs and clothes and stuff. Number two, Moses and Elijah, did you know their bodies were physically taken up into heaven? And when Jesus was on earth during his ministry, he took three of his guys up on a mountain, Mount of Transfiguration. And while he was up there, Moses and Elijah show back up. And in Luke's account, Luke chapter 9, right around verse 31, somewhere in there, it says they're speaking to Jesus about his exodus. So Moses and Elijah make it into the promised land with Jesus on the Mount of Transfiguration, and then they go right back up into heaven. I think they're coming back. Elijah, definitely. I mean, it says that he is going to come before the great and terrible day of the Lord. Malachi 4, read that on your own. Moses, probably, because it says that, you know, they can perform a drought. That would be like Elijah turning the river into blood in this passage. That sounds like Moses and bringing every plague. I think when you put all this together, it's Moses and Elijah. I don't know. I'm not 100% on that. I'm not dogmatic on that, but I will say, sounds like him. Whoever it is, it is someone to be sure, and two people that come from God and come on the scene. It could be in the spirit of Moses. I don't know. I'll stop. All right. Anyways, 1,260 days. Oh, there's that number again. There it is. 7 years. 42 months is half of that time. The Antichrist breaks his covenant halfway through, 42 months. Here, 1,260 days, 30 days in a month times 42, 1,260 halfway through the tribulation. If anyone tries to arm them, fire comes from their mouths and devours their enemies. This is how anyone who wants to arm them must die. How does that even work? Like, what would that even look like? Fire comes out of these two prophets' mouths to come and get people to try and arm them? What would that even look like? Well, I brought a little video here to help us understand. See what you think. Let's roll the film here. All right, anyway, so we don't have to watch the whole music video. Is it literal fire coming out of their mouths? I don't know. Could be like Jeremiah 5 says, because you have spoken this word, behold, I'm making my words in your mouth fire, and this people wood, and it will consume them. When that is being spoken through Jeremiah by God, what does that mean? Does it mean that Jeremiah is shooting a fireball out of his mouth, flamethrower? No, it's that his message has the authority and the judgment of God on those people. Just like Elijah in his day, when he would speak a prayer, fire would come down from heaven. Or think about it like this, when we read about the message that these men teach to these people, in Revelation 20, that message will be fulfilled. They will face the judgment of God. Verse 7, now, when they have finished their testimony, the beast that comes up from the abyss will attack them and kill them. So they're going to die after 3.5 years. Their bodies will lie in the public square of the great city, figuratively called Sodom and Egypt, where also their Lord was crucified. That, of course, is a reference to Jerusalem once again. For 3.5 days, some from every people, tribe, language, and nation will gaze on their bodies and refuse them burial. The inhabitants of the earth will gloat over them and will celebrate by sending each other gifts. This is the only point in the entirety of the book of Revelation where we see the people on earth celebrating. And what are they celebrating? Something profoundly wicked and evil. The murder of these two godly men. This is some kind of a sick, twisted, satanic holiday. It's literally, they're going out, they're on Amazon getting gifts. I mean, not literally on Amazon, but you know what I mean. Like, if Amazon exists when this happens, they're going to be out getting gifts. Like, what should I get for my mother-in-law on Happy Dead Prophet's Day? Like, you know what I mean? Like, they're thinking what we should buy each other. And they're sharing gifts with each other. They're so happy about all this that they're having a ad hoc celebration. But after the 3.5 days are over, so, you know, all the news stations on earth are going to be there watching this, and the bodies are going to be in the background, and the breath of life from God entered them. Could you imagine that, being a news anchor? You're there, you're like, hey, we're celebrating here down in Jerusalem, everything's going great, and then you just hear, and you turn around, and these two guys just stand right back up. Oh my God. They stood to their feet, and terror struck those who saw them. Then they heard a loud voice from heaven saying to them, come up here. And they went up to heaven. Sorry, that sounded really creepy. Come up here. No, it's probably gentler. And they went up to heaven in a cloud while their enemies looked on. While their enemies looked on. So for 3.5 days, they're throwing a whole celebration, big holiday, big party. And after 3.5 days, they're struck with terror. And they look on as these two men are being taken up into the cloud. That's the symbol of God's very presence. This would mean that they are vindicated. For 3.5 days, everyone says, see, they're under the curse of God. If you're unburied in the ancient world, if your body is just left there to rot and to be, you know, packed out by animals and dogs and so forth, that means that you're under the curse of God. If you're not buried in a proper Jewish burial. Here, they're just left there out on the ground. And everyone must have thought, oh, they finally got what they deserved. They refused them burial. Kind of like Mussolini, strung up. I don't know if you've ever seen those pictures. The Italians did not treat him well after World War II. Strung him up, threw rocks at him, drug him through the street. That's the imagery here. And after 3.5 days, they come right back to life. And God says, you're coming with me. And he takes them up into heaven. So what did we read here? First, we read that everyone will be focused on the city of Jerusalem at the end of human history. Is that plausible? No. Not until the last 100 years. When this was written, Jerusalem was on fire. I mean, it was toast. And it's been that way for 1900 years. Hasn't been until the 20th century that we've seen this entire picture turn around. In fact, isn't that weird? Doesn't that bother you? Here's Israel, 8,000 square feet. It's about the size of Jersey, okay? Tiny, tiny little nation. And yet, right now, when you turn on the TV or you surf the web, everyone has their eyes fixed on Israel. Here's the headlines, and I'm only taking those from the last week. Everyone looking at Israel. Boy, that wouldn't be plausible, except over the last 100 years, less than 100 years, 75 years. We also read that there's going to be a third temple in Jerusalem. Is that plausible? Let's think about this together. Right now, there is a group referred to as the Temple Institute, and they are gathering together people and money and ornaments and research and development. All of this R&D is being put toward rebuilding a third temple in Jerusalem. They've got the Kohanim. These are a Kohan is a priest. Maybe you've met somebody with the last name Cohen, C-O-H-E-N. That's from this line, a Levitical priestly line. The Kohanim are being gathered and trained to do the works in the third temple by the Temple Institute. Temple vessels, the ephod of the priest, the menorah, censers, all this different stuff. They write this on their website. The Temple Institute has called upon Israel's finest craftsmen and enlisted them in the historical task of recreating these sacred vessels and vestments. The vessels that you are about to view are all fit and ready for use in the Holy Third Temple. Guys, they've made all this. These are actual pictures here in many cases. Made out of gold, full gold menorah, the incense, the coverture for the high priest when he comes back on the scene, the ephod, the rubies, the jewels, all of this is ready to go. They've got this all banged out. It's all set to go. Five red heifers. They've been looking for red heifers. According to Numbers chapter 19, you need red heifers in order to be burned, sacrificed, and then their ashes are mixed with water, death with life, to atone for all the problems in the temple. They couldn't find pure red heifers. According to the Mishnah, you need hair. You can't have a single different hair next to a red hair. It has to be perfect red heifers. They found these 2 years ago. I guess three. We're in 2025, right? Yeah. 3 years ago. Here they are. They found them in Texas, of all places. Christian cattleman. He said, you know, I was raising these red heifers, and I always wondered, maybe God would use them in the third temple. And sure enough, somebody found out about them. They won all these beauty pageant awards and stuff for being so, I don't know what a good-looking cow looks like, but apparently these are pretty hot cows, I guess. And they all went there, and they picked them up. And now these guys are over in Israel right now, ready to roll. And a new Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin was the 70-person Supreme Court in Israel. They tried to assert themselves back in 05. Not well received. Israel's a very secular nation. I just point this out only to demonstrate that people are trying to move in this direction. Even today, there is political support for this. Here is a speech from the Secretary of Defense nominee, Pete Hegseth. This is when he was speaking in Jerusalem in 2018.
And as you stand there, you can't help but behold the miracle before you. And it got me thinking about another miracle that I hope all of you don't see too far away. Because 1917 was a miracle. 1948 was a miracle. 1967 was a miracle. 2017, the declaration of Jerusalem as the capital, was a miracle. And there's no reason why the miracle of the reestablishment of the temple on the Temple Mount is not possible.
Since he got the nomination, people have been showing this clip over and over and over because the Israeli-Palestinian war is such a tinderbox. That's probably not even the best word to describe it because it's already blowing up. It's everywhere. And he's saying, I don't see any reason why we can't build a temple in Israel right now. I can think of one reason. The third holiest site in the Muslim religion, Islamic religion, the Dome of the Rock currently stands over the Temple Mount. By saying something like that, what he's saying is we need to get rid of that Muslim mosque and put a temple on that Temple Mount. Ooh, boy, this is scary. I mean, when people are making comments like that, you're realizing this cannot go on forever. What we're seeing over in Israel right now, this is going to come to a head. Plausible. I mean, I don't know how it's going to happen. I don't know what they're going to do there, but I will say this. I'm saying it will happen. It will happen. The fact that we have Israel as a nation, a sovereign nation, that seemed inexplicable 75 years ago, but there they are. putting a temple on the Temple Mount. And finally, everyone on earth will look at these dead bodies for 3.5 days. It doesn't say that they will go and visit. How could everyone be looking at these people? I mean, that's totally implausible when this was written. It was implausible up until 100 years ago, 75 years ago. Today, if this happened today, there would be no problem with everyone, literally everyone on earth, seeing what is happening here. Just the push of a button, a swipe, a search, and there you are. You'd be able to see it live right there without even having to leave your couch. Well, what we're seeing here is that God is going to return to Israel. That's what the Bible teaches. It predicts that before the rescue of the church, after the rescue of the church, God is going to get back with Israel. And that is what we're seeing over and over in our Old Testament, over and over in our New Testament, and here in the book of Revelation. What we're also seeing is that what we just did is what's called hermeneutics. Think of the god Hermes, the messenger god. Hermeneutics is the art and science of interpretation. What does that mean? That means we're trying to interpret the intent of the author. Now, what do we do? Do we do something spooky here tonight, you know, where we kind of trying to pull whatever meaning we could out of the text? No. We were showing that all of these different texts from Jesus and Paul and Daniel and John, they interlock with each other. There's correlation with them. They're all saying Israel. They're all saying Jerusalem. They're all saying 7 years. All of it's interlocking. And what that shows us is that we can have a high level of confidence that the way that we're interpreting Revelation is correct. That when this goes down, it's going to go down the way that we just read it. There's too much correlation for any other option, in my mind. The passage of time also boosts our confidence. Many of these prophecies, in fact, all of them, made no sense up until the last 75 years. The time in which we live, right now, we're seeing that this makes perfect sense. The one that's the hardest to believe is that you'd have a temple on the Temple Mount with the Dome of the Rock. Again, I don't know how that's going to happen. But if you've got Israel there, it seems to me that if you've gone all the way to get Israel back in the land, getting a temple rebuilt, that shouldn't bother us at all. This is going to happen in the future. Finally, the two witnesses were cursed by the people, but they were approved by God. I'd like you to think about that. Like, I know many people, they just feel like, I just want to fit in. I just want to be with the crowd. I want to look around and see what everyone else is thinking and believing and saying. Did everyone else vote for that? Then I guess I'll do it too. I, like, you know, many of us believe that we are kind of, you know, free thinkers and we want to do what we think is right and stuff. But when everyone else's hand goes up, we kind of just mimic what they do. And what this is saying here is that that's not good enough. That at the end of the day, the only two eyes in the universe that matter will look on you with approval or will look on you with a curse. And these two men, I mean, they gave their lives. They will give their lives. And they'll die. And all of society at the time, they'll look at these two prophets and they'll say, oh, they're such a curse. Don't even bury them. Let's just have a celebration over their deaths. But God is the one who says, come with me. And if you're here tonight and you've never made a personal decision to know Jesus Christ because you've been looking at what other people believe, I don't know if I want to be one of those Jesus freaks or whatever. You know what I mean? Like, I don't want to turn into one of those people. Well, I guess you're just getting your beliefs from other people's opinion. Wouldn't it be of ultimate importance to not look at what people think, but what you think and what God thinks? Come to Christ tonight. There's nothing weird about this. This is just an internal expression of the heart whereby you say to God, I want to know you. I want the security that only you offer. And I want what Jesus did on the cross to apply to me. And when you do that, when you pray that, Christ comes into your life right then, right there. And that's a prayer that he will always answer. He is the one whose approval that you desperately want and you desperately need. And the good news is that you can have it if you ask. And then God will come into your life and you can have the security as you think about this whole endeavor.